Blog Talk Radio.
Pensando los velorios y qué le hacemos a Babalú. Dame 17 velas para ponerlo en cruz.
This is Jimmy Cottle. My daughter Amy and I never miss the Babalu Radio Hour on Blog Talk Radio.
Comes as sweet and clear as moonlight through the pines.
And welcome to another edition of the Babalu Blog Radio Hour. I'm your host, George Moneo, with a cold, so my voice is going to be sounding a little strange this evening. And I believe our co-host is on as well.
Absolutely. Henry Gomez here. Hello, George.
How are you, Henry?
Very well. Very excited about tonight's show.
Absolutely. We've got a corker tonight.
Yep.
We've been promoting this for a few days, and we mentioned this a couple of weeks ago on the blog. And our guest today, and I'm going to read his bio because this contains the information on him. Tonight we have Christopher S. Simmons. He's an active duty lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army. Career counterintelligence officer since 1987, one of America's foremost authorities on Cuban intelligence. From 1996 through 2004, Simmons was deeply involved with the majority of U.S. counterintelligence successes against Cuba. He was a central figure in the identification, investigation, and debriefing of convicted Cuban spy Ana Belén Montes. We owe him many beers for that. The highest-ranking Cuban spy ever sent to prison in the United States. Simmons was the lead military official in the May 2003 expulsion of 14 Cuban spies serving under diplomatic cover, the third largest diplomatic expulsion in U.S. history, and the only one not targeted against the USSR and Russia. He's lectured on Cuban intelligence throughout the U.S. intelligence community, the Congress, and in several academic or private sector forums. And I'm very pleased to welcome Christopher Simmons to the show. Good evening, Chris.
Good evening.
That's Colonel to you.
Yeah, Lieutenant Colonel. Sir. I'll just call him Sir for the rest of the evening.
That's right. You can never go wrong with Sir.
That's exactly right. Well, you know what?
Now, you can keep it informal. I'm here as a private citizen.
Exactly. You know what the non-coms say, right, Chris? They say, hey, we work for a living. No sir to us. Anyway, you know, we've been chatting on and off about this show, and obviously, you know, your appearance last week on Ocaraz de Ramon Olimpia is a great lead-in to what we're going to do tonight. But I wanted to really, you know, pick your brain a little bit and tell our audience that that's mainly, like I explained to you, we do the blog and the radio show in English because we want the American public, the English-speaking American public, to learn more about Cuba issues. In other words, stuff that is not discussed in the media, which, of course, is, in my opinion, completely co-opted by the regime. So we want to present the other side of the coin. And one of the things that I wanted to start with you tonight, Chris, is, and we've got 90 minutes, so, you know, you can take your time and say what you have to say. I want an overview of the history of Cuban espionage since the revolution in the United States, because the DGI, the Director General of Intelligence, has a fearsome reputation. For those of us who are, you know, spy buffs and history buffs, and they've always been ranked alongside Mossad and KGB as the preeminent, one of the preeminent intelligence services.
The East German Stasi.
And the East German Stasi, exactly. So I want to give you the floor so you can, you know, introduce yourself and talk a little bit about yourself and then talk about the history of the activities they've done here in the United States.
I'd be happy to. And I think what might be best starting off is to readdress some of the issues you brought up in the bio.
Mm-hmm.
There's been some confusion caused intentionally by a small cabal of misguided but enthusiastic others,
mm-hmm,
who've been trying to cast aspersions as to, am I an Army officer? You know, what's my expertise and so forth? And so let's just address that head on for the record. There's talk out there that I'm a former Defense Intelligence officer, and I am, but it's not former in a negative sense. It's former in terms of I retired last December from Defense Intelligence with a total of 25 years military and civilian service. And so
you're no amateur, obviously.
No amateur. I've got over a quarter century
exactly.
Service at this point. And again, some people can cast it as former DIA, but there's a difference between former and retired.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about accuracy, so let's stick with the facts. And I'm retired from the Defense Intelligence Agency and back on active duty with the United States Army.
Are you at liberty to say in what capacity you're currently employed by the United States Army?
A military intelligence officer, more specifically, my area of specialty is counterintelligence. And almost exclusively, that's where I've stayed since I became a military intelligence officer 21 years ago. And I've gravitated between, technically I serve in the Army Reserve, but the reality is over the last quarter century, I've spent 13 years active and 12 years reserve. And those 12 years reserves were over at the Defense Intelligence Agency, where I achieved the rank of what we call grade 15, which is the civilian equivalent of a full colonel. So I've done pretty well over the years. I'm not retired. I will not, and going to the Army, I will not retire for a couple more years yet. So let's take out all the former and retired and all the myth and innuendo out there. Because I'm still in the Army.
For the purposes of the listeners and our readers, you mentioned that you're speaking as a civilian. Now, obviously, what we're talking about is espionage in the United States being conducted by Cuba, by a foreign country. And I guess I think a question is on a lot of people's mind. I mean, the information that you're sharing, you have in some capacity been authorized to share. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely, and it's at no time tonight or any time else will I discuss classified information. And your question's a good one. A lot of people become very concerned as to how can I discuss Cuban intelligence operations. Mm-hmm. And it simply comes down to this, we're in the middle of the information age, and there's a tremendous volume of information out there if you just know where to look.
Yeah.
And I myself have been surprised at how much is out there, because the way I got into publicly discussing Cuba was several years ago at grad school, where for my thesis, I wanted to do Cuban intelligence. And so I thought at the time that I would do Cuban intelligence in Latin America, because I figured if I covered the whole region, I'd find enough to do a couple hundred pages for a thesis. And much to my surprise, I was overwhelmed, and I had to scale back the focus of my thesis to Cuban intelligence support to the Sandinistas. And based on that experience, which I shared with my colleagues at Defense Intelligence Agency and elsewhere, there is so much out there. And part of it is it's everything coming together in terms of there have been defectors coming across for half a century now.
Yeah, since the beginning.
Combined with volumes of declassified U.S. government information, with the fall of the end of the Cold War, there's actually a surprising amount of information now coming out of the old KGB archives, Romanian intelligence archives, and elsewhere detailing their relationships and Cuban intelligence officers and so forth. And then, of course, you have the regime itself, who is parading retired director of intelligence officers America's Department officers like Ulysses Estrada, and they're writing books on Cuban operations in Bolivia during the 60s and so forth. So when you pull it all together, again, when you've got 20 some odd years of doing this, it becomes relatively easy to paint a pretty clear picture and never have to use anything classified, because it's all out there in front of us.
Yeah, and it's four continents. I mean, the Cuban intelligence services, along with the military, work on four continents. It was Europe and Russia and Africa and Latin America, Central America and the United States. It's not, this is not just something that's isolated in Miami. The Cuban intelligence service has had its fingers in many, many pies. So, that's something that I think our audience needs to know. These were very serious people backed by KGB and Romanian intelligence and Hungarian intelligence and the Albanians, who were used for, they had an enormous number of activities going on throughout the Cold War, and some of them have been scaled back, obviously. But
Colonel, I just have a quick question. You mentioned, obviously there is a lot of material out there about Cuban intelligence and espionage operations. I guess my question, I might ask this again in a different way later, depending on how you answer it, but my question is this. I mean, you're, as a counterintelligence officer in the United States, you know, intelligence community, you've obviously had access to classified information. However, what you're saying is that the revelations that you've made recently on television, on radio, et cetera, they're all publicly documented cases. You may have, in fact, been informed, your opinion may have been informed by classified information, but what you're divulging is not classified information.
Correct, but even more precisely, I leave the opinion out of it, and what I focus on is what I've always been trained to do. Go with the evidence, and before I ever come out and identify someone as a Cuban agent, I'm going to have absolute proof that would – and not just – actually, when I say absolute proof, I'm looking at it from, again, a lifetime of putting people in prison, which is what I've done. In the last 21 years, I have ended the espionage careers of over 80 officers of different services, put a lot of people in prison. And so when I come forward and say that so-and-so is an agent, at the time I make that pronouncement, I am absolutely ready to go to court. You know, so if those that are out there that say I'm making allegations, I welcome the opportunity if someone can convince those that I've accused that they've been somehow defamed. My recommendation is take me to civil court, sue me for defamation, and I will parade my evidence in front of the world, and the court case is going to go from a civil case to a criminal case very quickly, and the people that I've accused will find themselves being charged by the government with espionage or being a representative of a foreign agent, or, given that some of them were paid, tax evasion for not declaring their Cuban salaries.
Hmm.
So it's, you know, if we want to cut straight to the chase, that's where I'm coming from.
Well, that's why
you don't have to believe me. And if you don't believe me, take me to court and make me prove it. Because I'm not the one going to jail.
The reason I asked, and I'm glad that you mentioned civil litigation, is I don't know if you're aware of this, but I personally have been threatened with a lawsuit by one of the people that you revealed on a Caraza show for repeating the allegations that were made by Professor De La Cova about her. I published them as a news item on my Herald Watch blog, and she had an attorney write me a lawyer letter, which I responded to. I offered her equal time to equal space to respond to the accusations, but I said I wasn't going to take them down because she's a public figure. She was being accused of something by a public figure, and I felt that I was entitled to the same rights as a media outlet, and I was covered by the First Amendment in that regard. And nothing ever became of it, which to me, you know, whether people want to see it that way or not, but to me validates the fact that she doesn't want to have depositions, bring people, witnesses out of the woodworks, you know, some of whom are defectors from Cuba, et cetera. So, but
volumes.
Yeah. So I'm glad we got that out of the way early, because we can talk about the other topics that we had. Now, George wanted to get like a little bit of an aspect of the historical factor. Maybe we can weave that in throughout the discussion. But you've mentioned, and you explained this on Oscar Asa's show, but I think, you know, obviously there's a translator there, and not all of our audience understands Spanish. So if you could explain the difference between an agent and an officer, and then what's the difference between an intelligence agent and an agent of influence?
I'd be happy to. And actually, if we can step back from that, the again, touching on credentials, when there's a lot of talking heads out there offering expert, you know, their assessments on Cuban national security affairs. But when it comes down to the intelligence services, those areas are best left to counterintelligence officers. And the reason I say that is that counterintelligence exists to do one mission, and that's identify and neutralize or eliminate other intelligence services. And so there will be no one better qualified to discuss how intelligence services, foreign services work than a counterintelligence officer, you know, whether it's myself or others who have spent years focusing on those very target sets. Now, when you're and as you're looking at how difficult a field is this, what it comes down to is espionage, when it's done correctly, is almost impossible to detect. And so for the counterintelligence officers, or spy catchers, whatever you'd like to call them, as the spy catchers chase these ghosts that are out there, if the ghosts are almost perfect, then the counterintelligence officers have to be perfect, mm-hmm. because that's the only way they're going to find a really talented intelligence officer engaged in espionage.
Well, the way I've read it, you know, from all the reading I've done, is you guys are basically chasing little wisps of smoke that are little clues, and those little wisps can disappear, and you guys are left with literally nothing at a certain point. I mean, it's a hell of a difficult job to do.
I just have a quick question related to that. I mean, you said that, you know, it's almost impossible to detect, you know, an espion. I'm wondering if you'd qualify that with in the United States or in an open society like we have, because I think there's a perception. I have the perception, and I don't know if George does, but that Cuban intelligence is much further penetrated into the United States than our intelligence is penetrated into Cuba.
Absolutely.
I chalk that up to the fact that Cuba is a closed society. It's a police state, whereas here it's much harder within the limitations of the Constitution and the law, obviously. And we live in an open society where there's freedom of movement, and there isn't surveillance everywhere. It's much easier for someone to get lost in the shuffle here.
Absolutely. And when we talk about Cuba as a police state, you need make sure everyone understands that when I or yourselves address Cuba in that phrase, a police state, that's not our assessment. That's actually, those are phrases used by several human rights groups historically to describe repression within on the island. And so when human rights groups are addressing Cuba and other nations as police states, you're absolutely right. And you can see it in the services themselves, because the Castro brothers right now field a constellation of five different intelligence services, totaling just over 11,000 personnel. The two largest services are counterintelligence services. One is military counterintelligence, and the other is the civilian counterintelligence service. And those two services combined total about 8,000 people.
Wow.
And so it's clear from that perspective that, you know, just looking at the manning, that the number one enemy of the Castro brothers isn't the United States. It's the Cuban people.
Mm-hmm.
And the United States, you know, the remaining 3,500 officers are predominantly targeted against the United States. But still, it comes down to there's over two officers targeting Cubans on Allen for every officer that's going against the United States. And that more than anything else, gives you a mindset of who the regime views as its two primary threats.
Chris, is Cuban intelligence divided up into domestic and international and maybe some other branch similar to...
Yes. Well, the way they've configured their constellation is the military has two intelligence services. It's counterintelligence side, called the SIM, military counterintelligence, and then it's foreign intelligence, director of military intelligence, we refer to as the DIM. Now, within the military, its foreign intelligence service is functionally aligned. And what I mean by that is military intelligence runs about 90% of all communications intercept operations conducted by the Cuban government. And so when it comes down to monitoring and intercepting communications, fax machines, cell phones, anything, that's done by military intelligence. Now, on the civilian side, of course, you have the DGI, our director, our DI, the Director of Intelligence, that is the Foreign Intelligence Service. They are the exact opposite of the military intelligence in terms that they have a minute intercept capability, and about 90% of all intelligence officers within Cuban intelligence are in the Director of Intelligence. And, of course, then you have its sister service, the Director of Counterintelligence. And the last service everyone's probably familiar with from the 60s, 70s, and 80s when it was called the Americas Department, run by Manuel Pinheiro, where it conducted revolutionary operations or support the revolutionary operations. It, along with the military, trained guerrillas, did political influence, did any number of subversive operations throughout the hemisphere.
And in Africa as well, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah. The Americas Department stayed within the hemisphere in Africa and rarely ventured anywhere else, whereas the other services had a broader base. Now, the Americas Department still exists, although with the end of the revolutions in the Western Hemisphere and changing times, it has been scaled back and restructured to what they now call the Americas area. And it remains, as it's always been, the intelligence wing of the Cuban Communist Party. The difference now is it is smaller than it's ever been, and its job is limited to political influence. So anytime you hear, for example, about the Cuban government interacting with Spain's ETA, you know, the terrorist group there, mm-hmm. it's always going to be handled by the Americas area, because while they're not training guerrillas and terrorists like they used to, in their political influence arena, they still handle solidarity, as they would call it, solidarity operations for revolutionary groups.
Like
so,
FARC? Would FARC
exactly. Be? FARC, ETA, any other, the remainder of the Puerto Rican terrorist groups.
Macheteros.
Exactly. Macheteros. Those are still handled by the Americas area. So there's probably about 200 or 300 of them left. But even though their mission's diminished and their manpower is diminished, they carry a lot of weight. What we are most used to dealing with historically is the DGI, or the Director of Intelligence, as it's now called, although we're now seeing former intelligence officers and current officers refer to the DI as the DGI again, the General Director of Intelligence, which would be a return to the status it had before the 89 Ochoa trials, when the DGI was gutted and restructured. 500 officers were fired, some of which were brought back. The loss of these 500 officers, they were replaced by military officers, and there are many that feel that the politics behind the Ochoa trial and everything, the corruption trials of the late 80s, were an effort by Raul to minimize the power or lessen the power of the Ministry of the Interior, which oversees the intelligence service, the DI, then DGI, because the way the government had been balanced, of course, you had Raul Castro in the Ministry of the Armed Forces, where he led the military and had military and counterintelligence and foreign intelligence. But when, as the Minister of the Armed Forces, his intelligence, his foreign intelligence was limited to signals intercept, which historically, according to factors, has been amazing to the extent that from everything we're told to this day, the Castro regime collects more intercepted communications than it can ever process.
It's worth reminding our audience that for many, many years there was a Soviet listening post at Lourdes in Cuba,
which Putin and the new president Medvedev said that they might reopen recently.
They might, but I'm not sure that they would, because I and others believe that the whole rationale between the Russians closing that site wasn't an act of kindness or anything for the United States, but simply their realization that they didn't need their site because Cuban military intelligence had become so skilled at intercepting U.S. communications that their site was largely redundant. And at the time, it was costing the Russians about $500 million to keep that site in operational. And so even if Cuban military intelligence wasn't getting everything that the Russians were,
the cost-benefit analysis.
Yeah.
Exactly. Moscow to be able to go to Cuba and say, look, you do this, give us what you're – you continue to give us what you've been getting, and we'll pay you, pick a number, $200 million. They still walk away the winner financially and politically, because the U.S., they spin it to the U.S. that, it was an act of, political kindness, if you would.
Détente.
Exactly. And, and you look what happened about 2000, as some people are increasingly aware, the Chinese moved officers into the Cuban site at Bejucal, just outside of Havana. And so, again, from the defectors and emigres that I've talked to, the Chinese aren't manning any of the electronic equipment. They don't have to. They're off in their own little rooms, and the Cuban military intelligence personnel are bringing them copies of everything that's come in that would be of interest to Beijing. And the Chinese are simply processing it and sending it out through their diplomatic facilities in Havana to hide the volume that is leaving from Cuba.
Well, you know, this speaks to something I've said for years, which is you constantly hear in the American media and from apologists and the like that Cuba's just a little country.
It
poses no threat. I mean, you know, Cuba's a little country.
Ana Montes wrote those words.
Yeah. And you know, and I can tell you, and Henry can tell you, you know, from family experiences, I mean, you know, for half a century, as long as I've been able to listen to my parents and grandparents and family members, they've always said, you know, we have a nest of spies here. Cuba is actively trying to destroy this country. You know, it's not something that we heard. It was obviously apocryphal, but my goodness, it's true. It was then, and it is today.
Well, I think that it's worth mentioning just for people that can't connect the dots that might be obstinate about this. But Cuba militarily is not going to defeat the United States. But what Cuba can inflict a lot of damage to the United States through the sale of their intelligence product.
Absolutely.
And I would think that it's a pretty important export for Cuba, and it has been. Was that a fair assessment?
No, that's an excellent assessment, and it's something I've been saying for years. In fact, the term I've been using, which has now become very popular, is that Cuba is an intelligence trafficker.
Hmm.
And I think that best captures what actually occurs here, because from the regime's perspective, what it came down to is throughout the Cold War, they already had very advanced liaison relationships and intelligence exchanges with the Russians and numerous others. Well, with the end of the Cold War and the economy goes in the basket, and there are budget cuts everywhere, they quickly realize that intelligence is a commodity. Not only is it a commodity, in some cases it's a perishable commodity, that once the regime is finished processing it for its own use, is of immense value to a lot of other allies. And so you're absolutely right. Cuba is not a military threat. They're not an economic threat. And all that becomes irrelevant when they have the capability to steal our nation's highest secrets and traffic them to whoever has an interest. And again, I'm using the word traffic intentionally because it's not about selling the information. Of course, Havana will sell the information to anyone who can pay. But for those nations that cannot pay, what they've gone to is a barter process. And the one constant rule in Havana is nothing is free. But we know from all sorts of available sources that they will trade information with the most impoverished nations of the world that need it, for example, votes in the UN. Because for the regime to be able to call in that marker whenever they need it, is that's an investment.
Like every year when they condemn the U.S. trade embargo against Cuba. Let me take a step back and talk about Ana Belén Montes. We mentioned her earlier. There may be people that listen to this podcast later on, because we're going to promote the hell out of it, that aren't as familiar with the issue of Cuba and this espionage issue. For the person who's not familiar, please, you know, briefly explain who Ana Belén Montes was, and more importantly, I mean, we all know that she was in the Pentagon, or she was, you know, in the Defense Intelligence Agency, and she was a high-ranking person in that agency. Can you explain to us in a simple way the level of that she was at in terms of how high her seniority was in terms of the types of information that she would have, how damaging it was to the United States to have somebody like that as an agent of a foreign country.
Oh, I'd be delighted. But if you'll indulge me for one moment before we neck down to Ana Montes, for your listeners, to provide some context of what does it mean for Cuba to be an intelligence trafficker, bear in mind that there's a really good site out there called the Federation of American Scientists, which provides profiles of intelligence services around the world. And for those interested in national security issues, intelligence services, they need to be cognizant that about 150 nations in the world conduct espionage on any given day. And so, again, it's not the idea that intelligence is something that major powers and regional powers and superpowers do is so far from the truth that it's almost absurd, because what we're talking about,
that's 70% of the countries, more or less.
Exactly, because in the context of espionage or intelligence collection, is the world's, as some people like to joke, intelligence is the world's second oldest profession.
I thought politics was. I guess this is the third.
Because all nations have the same interest, and that's self-protection. So they don't want to be afraid, for their sovereignty. And so that's at the heart of it, and then the desires for intelligence services grow from there. And so when you're looking at Cuba as an intelligence trafficker, when you look at the globe and think that 70 or 80% of every nation, all the nations around the world, have intelligence services, it quickly becomes clear that there are a lot of countries where Cuba provides a level of access that no one else can achieve. And again, just very quickly, that is why the Chinese are at Behukol, because that site can collect everything from northern Canada to the tip of Argentina. So the Chinese would be insane to build their own site when they've already got guys with half a century of experience doing this.
But before we get to Ana Montes, I have a very brief question. How much, for our audience, you've got two things that are collected, I guess. It's human intelligence versus signals intelligence, I guess.
Correct.
And signals intelligence is electronics, stealing paperwork, hacking into this and the like. And then human intelligence is what's gathered by people in the field who are pretending to be something they're not. What percentage of human intelligence versus signal intelligence is what's collected? I mean, do you have an idea of...
By who? By them or by us?
How effective... Which one is more effective to the Cuban intelligence service, the human or the signal?
That's the million-dollar question that we don't have an answer to.
Yeah.
I can tell you, from a manpower perspective, the two sides are about equal in size. Both the military intelligence and the DI, you're looking at about 1,300 personnel. But you have to bear in mind, human intelligence has a very large, what we in the military would call tooth-to-tail ratio, which means for every officer and agent that's out forward, you have logistical people, you have analysts, you have administrative people, you have a lot of people in the back that are doing everything else to keep those guys forward. And so the number of actual officers afield is going to be realistically probably a third, maybe 40% of the entire structure of the Directorate of Intelligence at best.
Wow.
Now, when you look at the DIM, they can sit at Behukol, and I should add, they have covert SIGINT sites in several locations around the world, reportedly at the Cuban Intersection in Washington, D.C., as well as a second site at the Cuban Mission to the UN. And those sites do what we would call close-in intercept, where the covert sites are only good for about 50 miles. But they generally have line of sight to whatever they're collecting. And so the quality of their collection is better, and they're going to pick up a lot more of the intimate details simply because they're in the immediate presence of communications. So in terms of who can collect more, the military is. The DIM is collecting far more intelligence than the DI. But when it all gets fused together, humans are the only ones that can shape the future. And so the military is collecting what has occurred and what is about to occur and plans for events down the road, whereas an officer running an agent somewhere in the United States, they can shape the future. And so the two have to work together. It's not a matter of who collects more. It's you have to have both and have to work together because one feeds the other.
Yeah, which kind of segues nicely into
Shaping. Shaping.
Yes, yeah. It does.
Yeah, it segues nice into Montes, who was, at least when it came out, she was considered one of the most, biggest catches of the last 50 years in the United States in terms of espionage. And I think you were involved in that, so please, tell us what you can.
I'd be happy to. With Ana Montes, she was actually recruited by Cuban intelligence before she ever came to the Defense Intelligence Agency. She was working at the Department of Justice, in fact, doing Freedom of Information requests. While she was doing her graduate studies at Johns Hopkins up in Baltimore, she was, we call spotted and assessed by an individual who recognized her sympathies towards Cuba and other revolutionary governments. And according to open source, we believe she was she went to New York, where an intelligence officer out of the Cuban mission to the UN recruited her. And the reason they went to New York, we believe, is at the time, historically, the Cuban mission to the UN is the hub for all espionage operations in the United States. It was only much later that the Cuban interest section in D.C. started conducting traditional espionage.
Well, for a long time, the only diplomatic mission in the United States for Cuba was the one at the UN until the interest sections were established.
Correct. They actually had, in the early 60s, Cuba enjoyed a lot of Prensa Latina offices throughout the United States, which they used as cover for intelligence operations. But, of course, those, with the end of diplomatic relations, all those sites were closed. And so what Cuba was forced to build was a large – in the intelligence world, we work in two environments. One environment is called legal officers or legal operations. And what a legal operation or a legal officer does – it's not to imply that the espionage you're conducting is legal by any means. All it really conveys is that the officer involved in the espionage is a diplomat.
Exactly.
And as a diplomat, he or she can never be arrested. The worst that can happen is they will be declared persona non grata and thrown out of the country. And so legal officers, no matter how heavy-handed, no matter how sloppy they get, their operations can never truly be eliminated because there will always be diplomats. Now, at the other end of the spectrum, you have illegal officers and illegal operations. And that's the Hollywood-style espionage. Those are officers under deep cover. If they're doing it correctly, no illegal Cuban illegal officer in the United States should even come across as a Cuban. What they would want to portray themselves is as some other nationality, so that anybody interacting with them, the last thought crossing their mind is they're dealing with someone from the island.
Mm-hmm.
The illegal will convince them that they're from any other country in the world that fits their appearance and mannerisms and everything else.
That was me and switching phones, by the way. So
I thought we were being bugged.
We probably are. Just kidding. But for Ana Montes, so what in all likelihood occurred is she started off being run by legal officers out of New York. Now, if you look at a map, it is impossible to handle an agent in Washington from the confines of the Cuban mission to the UN for an extended period. I mean, that is too high risk for the officer and the agent, because in a normal situation, what a Cuban officer would like to see from a productive agent is a meeting about every second week. And I don't care how good you are, if you're a Cuban agent driving from Washington to New York City every other weekend, you're going to get caught.
Yep.
And so at some point, they had to have turned her over to an illegal officer. And by tradecraft, an illegal officer probably would have lived actually in the D.C. area. And so she would have had an officer whose job was to handle her, maybe some others. And that would be the illegal sole mission in life, to keep her in the game as long as possible, provide her training when needed, give her feedback on what she was providing to make sure that she knew when she had too much in one area, not enough in others, commend her when she performed well, reprimand her when she went afield, and keep her focused on Cuban requirements. Excuse me. And so after she was recruited, we're not sure whether she was directed or whether she volunteered, but she sought out a job with a higher level of clearance, because at Justice, all she had access to was secret material.
She went through a NAC and all that.
Exactly, and for someone of her mindset, and I think Carmichael summed it up when he called her, with his book True Believer, she passionately believed in what she was doing. And so, whether she was tasked to go find a job in a community or volunteered to do it.
She was a fellow traveler from the word go.
She was, and had she not been tasked, she would have volunteered to do it anyway, because that's just the way her mind worked. And so she sought out employment. Defense Intelligence Agency had the misfortune of hiring her. And then everything that could go wrong did go wrong for the United States in terms of where we assigned her. Not knowing at the time she was a Cuban agent, she was put on El Salvador and Nicaragua, which, as everyone is aware, this is 1985.
Right.
We're fighting a secret war in El Salvador, as well as, supporting Contras in Honduras and Nicaragua. And we've got a Cuban agent that is reading this information every day and then passing it to her case officer.
I got a question for you, Chris. Was she cleared for word only or eyes only or SCI stuff, or it was just top secret stuff that she was wanting, what she was looking at?
She was able to look at initially up through top secret and with some caveats, and then over the years her access grew and it's not a matter of, I think too often people look at it in terms of, you know, did she have access to secret? Did she have access to top secret? And what people need to understand is there's a difference between having classified material and having a need to know specific classified material. And what she was able to do over time is through force of personality get access to information she should never have had access to. Yeah, whether it was convincing people, you know, being very persuasive, or simply intimidating more junior personnel, there were countless episodes where somebody should have raised a red flag and said, there's a problem with, you have a problem with a political military analyst asking for this information, and for too long, nobody raised a concern.
Yeah, that's a red flag.
Now, just so for the purpose of clarity, the implications of her having access to materials with regards to Central America during that period of time, where we had were not only supporting certain factions in the area, but where there were actually American troops and advisors in those areas. And I think Carmichael raises the specter of the potential that American troops potentially lost their life because of information that Ana Belén Montes passed along to the Cubans. And there's no doubt in my mind that our allies lost lives as a result of Ana Belén Montes' activities.
Oh, absolutely. And from my vantage point, that's exactly the reason that I think Ana Montes is more damaging than any of the other spies since the end of the Cold War. And I say that very aware that the fact that, you know, I'm comparing her with, you know, Ames and Hansen and others who got a lot of our agents overseas killed. And the reason I make that point is, as Carmichael pointed out in his book, Ana Montes, for the 3 years she was the El Salvador desk officer, was briefing our special operations forces that were going into El Salvador. And then she was providing that information to Cuba, who then provided it to the FMLN guerrillas, with the expectation that at some point the guerrillas were going to be able to kill Americans because of what she provided. And I can think of no other spy since the early days of the Cold War that actually tried to get Americans killed. And for those unfamiliar with the secret war in El Salvador, in a nutshell, what occurred was from 1980 to 1991, we secretly rotated 5,000 special operations personnel through that country, under the guise of training the El Salvadoran armed forces, which we certainly did, but our special operations personnel also went out on combat patrols with our Salvadoran allies, and over 20 were killed in combat or in shoot downs. And there is one notorious incident Carmichael talks about, because he and I worked it together, involving the death of Sergeant Gary Fronas. who was killed in 1987 when the FMLN overran a Salvadoran base camp. In the largest military operation of the war, and mind you, this, at the point where they overran this camp, Ana Montes had visited this camp personally in the months prior, and so we know for a fact the guerrillas did have their own informants on the camp.
She but was confirmation to those informants, basically.
It was, and you have to look at it from... In the counterintelligence world, we like to say there's no such thing as a coincidence. Because in an abstract sense, yes, there is. But when you're assembling this puzzle we call espionage, and you look at Ana Montes and her, you know, recurring briefings of special operations personnel, you look at her five-week tour of El Salvador, which again was then followed by the largest military operation of the war, killing 80 some odd, over 80 Salvadoran soldiers in Garry Fronas. That's not an accident.
No, it's not. Chris, and, let me interrupt you very briefly. The hour has flown, an hour has flown by already. Let me take a very short break here, and I want to bring somebody on that person already just hung up. Well, let me do a little identification at the top of the hour here, and then let's get back to Montes and other issues that Henry and I will bring up. And we've got we had a full board a moment ago, and two people have dropped off. I hope I hope Humberto calls back because he was on the phone waiting there. Anyway, here we go. Let's do a little promo here.
This is Bill Clinton. I never have sexual relations while I'm listening to the Babaloo Radio Hour on Blog Talk Radio.
Me and Mrs. Jones, we got a thing.
Back on the air.
Your former commander-in-chief.
Your former commander-in-chief. That's right. That's right. Chris, listen, you did a hell of a job, and I love you for it. I always like to poke fun at him, but what can I tell you? You know, I think you've this hour has educated us tremendously, and I think that there's even more greater wealth to get out. In terms of the stuff that goes on. You were also involved with the famous Avispa Red, the WASP network here in Miami, which I believe involved the Brothers to the Rescue shoot-down and the like. Henry, do you want to ask something else? Because I'd love, you know, for him to tell us what he can about that case, because it's...
Absolutely, it's, and then... We have to talk about Marifelli and Alberto Cole.
Exactly, the subject of the evening. But, we hear it, we see it in the liberal media, Free the Cuban Five, you know, the heroes, this and that. And I want you to talk to the fact that these aren't heroes by any stretch of the imagination, and what their activities were. Here locally and maybe even nationwide. I'm not familiar with whether or not they were involved outside of the Miami-Dade County or the South Florida area or not. But go ahead and tell us a little bit of whatever you can on the WASP network.
Be more than happy. As we discussed the WASP network, I actually had very little. My only role came in after the fact, doing analysis for the U.S. Attorney. My hat is off to the FBI and Naval Criminal Investigative Service for their role, working together and bringing down the largest network of Cuban agents and officers that we've seen. In a nutshell, what occurred with the WASP network is Miami, South Florida has always been the central point of Cuba's operations in the United States. And so before we ever get to the WASP network, take it back to 1959. In 1959, more specifically in April of 1959, Cuba set up its first intelligence center in the United States, and it was based in Miami. Within a month, it was consolidating and overseeing operations being run by the military and the civilian services. Well, the military services at that time, before everything developed. And as of 1959, according to declassified CIA documents, the Cuban base in Miami was handling 40 to 50 agents. Now, when for a base to have 40 to 50 agents, the rule of thumb in the intelligence world is agents are run by officers. So the agent is usually, in this case, it would be the U.S. person or a Cuban-American or someone who's actually conducting the espionage, you know, stealing documents and everything else. They're run by a career staff member of what was in the G2, military intelligence. And so the staff member, the career employee, is the officer. And the officers run agents. Rule of thumb is an average case officer can run 3 average agents. So if we're talking that there are 40 to 50 agents in the United States in 1959 in South Florida, that tells you there were 15 to 20 officers out there in South Florida. So the regime has decades of experience in South Florida. Now you take that up to the 1990s. Part of the catalyst for the WASP network was the move of U.S. Southern Command out of Quarry Heights, Panama, to Miami. Mm-hmm. And what we're able to see is the reassignment of officers from other sites in the United States to Miami during the mid-1990s, early 1990s. Excuse me. So that they would be in place by the time Southern Command moved. And so when Southern Command moved, the WASP network was already had years of effort already underway and was actually pretty spread out in terms of the WASP network collected against the Cuban exile population and military sites from Boca Chica to Homestead Air Force Base, to Southern Command Headquarters, up to Tampa, which is home of both the U.S. Special Operations Command and now U.S. Central Command, which oversees Middle East operations. And in what is a really unusual twist is the WASP network also covered Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana. Because Barksdale Air Force Base is where our strategic bombers are launched from. But what we saw with that is a large network focused on both what Havana would call counter-revolutionary targets, the Cuban exile population. Exactly. But also with a strong coverage of military targets. And so this gave us a great chance to watch both the DI and the DIM. And the reason the DIM is so important is, like we discussed earlier, the DIM's human intelligence footprint is very small. And when the arrest of the WASP network went down in the latter half of the 90s, no agent, no officer was military intelligence. So we know they were involved with DIM. There were court documents outlining some of the DIM requirements and the DIM's role.
Mm-hmm.
But not only is the DIM very small, they were able to escape capture and detection. And they lived to fight on another day. And to this day, there has never been a DIM agent arrested in the United States.
Now, I think it's worth clarifying for the audience that the WASP network was way more than just the five people that Cuba now claims are these patriots that are being held wrongly in federal prison. There was something in the high teens, if I'm not mistaken, of people that were caught up in this network. I believe some of them cooperated and pled guilty. Those are not mentioned by the regime when they're talking about the WASP network. Others escaped, if you could just talk about that.
Oh, yes. The.
And I want to get some callers on. We've got a full board, so.
Okay, I'll be very quick. To sum up the WASP network, yes, when the arrest occurred, and there have been a total of 13 officers and agents of the WASP network arrested. But what a lot of people miss is, as you pointed out, several others escaped, or we know from court documents several others escaped, and there were several diplomats that were declared persona non grata because they were handling agents in the network. And so what it came down to is, according to the court proceedings, 18 agents and officers were arrested, known to have escaped, or declared persona non grata. And what's also interesting in the court documents is nowhere in the court documents or anywhere else does it ever say that, despite the brilliant job by the FBI and NCIS, we did not get most of the network. And so you figure if we took care of 18 of them, there were, according to the court documents, at least 37 officers and agents in that network. So, I mean, that is, it is huge. And most people totally miss that because, again, despite the success, no one ever wants to stand up there and say, we arrested a lot of them, but most of them got away.
Wow. Let me ask you real quick, of the five, the famous five, are there any officers among them? Are they agents? Do we know?
The key ones are officers, and the reason the five, as you pointed out, are so important to the Castro regime isn't because the regime believes that they are heroes. Well, I take that back. The regime believes they are heroes. But the fundamental reason that Havana is paying so much attention to them is of the others. Again, remember, 13 officers and agents were arrested. All but five went state's witness and testified against Cuba. And so the last thing the regime wants is for these last five, who include its hardest officers within the WASP network, they don't want them to roll over on the regime. And so everything you hear about Free the Five is simply propaganda to let those five know that they're not forgotten, and please do not betray, you know, again, from Havana's regime perspective, do not betray the regime. Because the... That is the one and only reason that whole campaign exists.
Do you think there's any hope of any of them rolling over for reduction in sentences? Or
you can... Hope springs eternal.
Yeah.
Well,
you can only spend so many years in prison before you start having second thoughts.
Yeah. Fortunately, at least until now, it's very rare case that a federal judge rules based on propaganda campaigns. So So hopefully these guys remain behind bars and serve out their sentences.
Yeah, definitely.
Then get their asses deported.
Let me say a couple things to the callers that are on, because we've got a full board and probably people are, you know, planning to call in. I'm going to take the calls in order. The 301 area code, do me a favor. Ask Lieutenant Colonel Simmons your question. Let him answer it, because I want to take I have Humberto Fontova on the line, and I've got Professor De La Cova on the line, and I want to get them in for their say before we have to switch off. Now, we're going to go over the 90 minutes, so you guys don't worry about time or whatever. It'll show up in the podcast. It just won't be streamed live. But tomorrow the podcast will be available, or actually tonight around 11:15, I guess, Henry. That's about when they post it. So.
Yep.
So anyway, let's take 301 area code first. He's been on the line for a while. 301 area code, you're on the air.
So you guys don't worry about time or whatever. So oh, he's listening.
I'm going to do the Art Bell thing. Turn your radio off. Okay, let me pause him, and then let me get Humberto, who's been waiting for almost 40 minutes here. Humberto, I believe you're on the air.
Is for these last five.
Humberto?
Hardest officers within the Washington.
He's listening to the radio too. now I know what they go through on a daily basis. Humberto, are you on? You're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. Hey. Hello.
What's up?
Hey, man. Hey, Lieutenant Colonel. Listen, I've never been one to be called impartial or scholarly or respectable. So I will lay it on the line in three words. With my introduction, Lieutenant Colonel Simmons, you're the man, okay? You're the man. Listen, I need to know one thing. I need a soundbite here for something I'm writing, because it is my desperate hope that your story penetrates the Iron Curtain that surrounds Little Havana and Miami-Dade in these cases.
Yeah.
And I'm desperate that this get into Washington, into New York, and in my extremely, extremely modest capacity, I'll try to help at that. But let us say in comparison to Alger Hiss was State Department, Harry Dexter White was Treasury Department. Now, Ana Belén Montes was Defense Intelligence Agency. Have we ever had an enemy agent penetrate the Defense Intelligence Agency as highly as did Ms. Montes?
No. In its 50-year history, there have only been four employees of DIA that were charged with espionage. And Ana Montes is hands down the highest-ranking foreign officer ever arrested from the intelligence community or DIA.
Yeah, that's what I suspected, but I need to hear it from the man. Also, another thing, it amazes me. Obviously, the agents that you mentioned, you've been mentioning over the last week or so, are agents of influence. And so, imagine I'm not the only one. There's a lot of people that say, well, wait a minute. If their job is to influence U.S. foreign policy and the U.S. media in favor of the Castro regime, why isn't 80% of the Democratic Party, 90% of Hollywood, and 100% of academia behind bars? You know, this is the thing that strikes us. There has to be a distinction here. Could you please explain to us what that distinction is?
Yeah, is being an agent of influence a crime, and what makes it a crime?
Oh, well, I can do better than that.
I'm
being an agent.
So we can take the other calls, okay?
Being an agent of any sort is a crime, and the crime is called espionage. When we talk about someone as an agent of influence, that's just their area of expertise. What we need to, you know, we need to keep our eyes on the ball, which is the person's an agent. They are trained. They are tasked. They receive guidance and feedback from the Castro regime, and they manipulate U.S. policy in support of a foreign power. So, you know, all politics aside, it's one thing for someone to
be an advocate.
Be an advocate, exactly, of their own free will. It's another thing when their actions are undertaken on behalf of a foreign nation. And that's what an agent of influence does, is they use their position within academia, within Congress, within whatever sphere they are in, operate to discreetly shape things to provide Havana the most favorable environment for them to conduct diplomatic and other activities.
For their foreign policy objective, whatever their objectives are.
Exactly.
A quick question. Can somebody be an agent and not know it?
It is possible. The Director of Intelligence has a phrase for it. It's called a person of confidence. And in rare cases, a person of confidence can be so naive or so blind to their own political tendencies that they don't see what's right in front of them.
Hmm.
But
somebody who's being used, in other words.
Correct. But in the case of the individuals I named, they are not persons of confidence. When I've got notes from their case officer, and he is talking about he tasked them, he graded their collection. They are not unwitting agents of influence. They are very clearly witting, and in one case, salaried agent of influence. So when we talk about agents of influence, it's not like they are inferior to other agents. They are doing what they're doing. Their mission is simply different from traditional espionage.
I'm going to take the next call is going to be from 305 area code, and then we're going to go to Dr. De La Cova because 305 has been holding on. And then 301, you got to turn your radio down in a little bit, maybe listen in on hold. But 305 area code, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, 305 area code, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, we're here.
Hello, am I on the air?
Yes, you are.
Hi, this is Janet.
Hey, Janet, how are you?
Sorry, I'm having to do it on my phone tonight. I can't get through on my computer. My question would be, do you think all of this against all these agents that they put in jail and suspected will ever be declassified?
Yes, at some point. The problem is within the intelligence world, we tend to be very secrecy obsessed, and a lot of that is rightfully justified. But sometimes it's things remain classified for much longer than they need to, or other considerations come into bear where, for example, you may not have the complete puzzle. And so you'll have information suggesting that someone or a group of people may be agents. And it becomes a question of, do you declassify information that you don't have an answer to and will never be able to prove whether they are or are not agents, and let people make their own conclusion. And we still have that problem actually with some of the World War II documentation. There are still, when you talk about longevity, there are still secrets from World War II that have not yet been declassified.
Yeah.
And so our understanding of World War II is imprecise. And so I'm confident that based on what we know and don't know, it will easily be half a century before we fully understand what has occurred.
Yeah, very briefly before I put Professor De La Cova on, the ultra secret, the secret to the decoding of Enigma, wasn't really made public for 30 years. I believe the first one was Stevenson's book, The Ultra Secret, which came out in 74, 75. And that was 30 years after the fact, and nobody had any idea about what U.S. and British intelligence had done with Enigma. So,
by the way, Chris, just so that you know, that was Janet Weininger. She's the daughter of Pete Ray, the American Bay of Pigs pilot that was shot down. She won a judgment, actually, against the regime. So we want to thank Janet.
For absolutely. Thank you, Janet, for calling in. I had to mute you. I'm going to go ahead and put the esteemed Professor Dr. Antonio de la Cova on the line. How are you, Professor?
Good evening. Greetings and congratulations to Lieutenant Colonel Chris Simmons, George Moneo, Henry Gomez for this fascinating program. I'm reminded of the rap song by Chris Cross that says, warm it up, Chris. I'm about to. So warm it up, Chris, because I'm about to. All right? So for the record, I just want to briefly read part of that 1983 debriefing of DJI defector Captain Jesus Perez Mendez in reference to Marifeli Perez Estable, the professor of Florida International University, who's a member of the Miami Herald's editorial board of contributors. And she's vice president for democratic governance at the Inter-American Dialogue in Washington, D.C., which shows how high she's gone up the ladder, just like Ana Belén Montes. Okay? And Perez Mendez said that Isidro Gomez and Jesús Arboleda Cervera of the DGI placed Marifeli Perez Estable in charge of the Círculo de Cultura Cubana. She substituted the deceased Lourdes Casal, who was DGI. The annual plans of Marifeli are prepared by the DGI annually and by the Institute, the Cuban Institute of Friendship with the People. Her Círculo de Cultura Cubana and the Antonio Maceo Brigade were maintained with funds from the sale of books and records that the Cuban Cultural Ministry delivered to her, okay? Marifeli receives $100 for each tourist that travels to Cuba with the Círculo de Cultura Cubana, and I'm sure she was not declaring this on her income tax. Okay. And then I heard what you mentioned about Ana Belén Montes, and I just want to make a couple of comments on that. First of all, it's interesting that when arrested, this woman was 44 years old, and she had never been married, even though she had gone through a whole slew of boyfriends throughout her lifetime. She was always the bridesmaid, never the bride. Okay, she is a Puerto Rican that she and her family advocated independence for Puerto Rico, which is a major tenet of Fidel Castro's foreign policy. And something else that struck me about her was that she attended Mass every Sunday, just like the spy couple, Carlos Alvarez and his wife, did out of FIU. It's interesting, though, that when she was, another thing I found interesting was that she was recruited out of that Cuban exchange program, out of John Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, that was founded and headed by Wayne Smith, former head of the Cuban Interest Section. And something else...
And current apologist for the regime.
Yeah, the name we know and love very, very much here in South.
Right. And something else that struck me about her was that when she was hired by the Defense Intelligence Agency, she admitted that she had prior use of marijuana and cocaine. Prior to her arrest, she had been afflicted with anxiety, sleeplessness. She was being treated with psychiatric counseling, given prescription medication. And in spite of all of this, she continued shaping perceptions and influencing White House policy, drafting the remarks of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff when he testified before Congress, and receiving all kinds of certificates of distinctions and awards from DIA, CIA, and the U.S. Army. My question to Colonel Simmons is, why do you think that the Cuban regime has not added Ana Belén Montes, Carlos Alvarez and his wife to the list of the five spy heroes, even though all three of them served the regime a longer and were more profitable than actually anything the five bumbling fools ever did.
Well, from Havana's perspective, everything is black and white. And their viewpoint is Ana Montes and the Alvarezes took a deal, as did the other eight arrested members of the WASP network. And so what they had, the sacrifices and successes they had made in the past for the revolution evaporated.
Nullified.
Exactly. Their slate was wiped clean and they ceased to exist. And the only ones that matter for the Castro brothers are the five that did not take a deal.
Amazing.
Yeah, correct.
And that's historically, it is a zero sum game for them. You are useful until the day that you betray them, and then you're in a figurative sense, you're dead.
I want to talk real quick since we have Professor De La Cova and I want to just for my own edification. Obviously, Professor De La Cova, you've published on your website LatinAmericanStudies.org that debriefing document of Jesus Perez Mendez, a defector. I believe that debriefing took place in 1982. You saw
July 15, 1983.
Okay. you saw a copy of that debriefing document. You were not allowed to photocopy that. You were a journalist at the time, right?
Yes, that's correct. I was living in Puerto Rico in 1987, and a Puerto Rican intelligence agent that was working with the FBI in conjunction with Cuban espionage in Puerto Rico and Cuban sponsoring terrorist activities in Puerto Rico through the America's Department, showed me this FBI memorandum document. And because I was a journalist, and basically the Puerto Rican intelligence officer was asking me, do you think this is legit? Is this defector exaggerating? Is he lying? What's your opinion on this? And I told him, I said, hey, this guy is right on the money. And I immediately asked him, let me photocopy this. He said, no, because sometimes when these documents circulate internally, they have certain markings or certain words that can be traced right back to where they originated from. So what Ted was, you can write it all out by hand. You can copy it by hand. And that's what I did. And I had that until I quoted from it in 1993. And then when Perez Mendez went on the Maria Elvira radio program in November of 2006 is when I decided to release the entire debriefing, which is on my page, which I have dedicated to Dr. Marifeli Perez-Stable at www.latinamericanstudies.org/Marifeli, MARIFELI .htm. I'm sorry, it was latinamericanstudies.org/espionage/Marifeli.htm.
Now, my question for Colonel Simmons is beyond the information that Professor De La Cova has posted, I mean, is there other documentation that you've seen that you're aware of that links Dr. Perez Estable to Cuban intelligence?
Oh, absolutely. Separate from the debriefing, Dr. De La Cova actually did a separate piece including, and I don't have the article in front of me, but it has photographs of Marifeli with known Cuban intelligence officers, and his article outlines, you know, testimony in front of Congress regarding, you know, her identification and with ECAP, the friendship organization you identified earlier, which is populated by then DGI officers with a large collection of collaborators. And so you've got a debriefing by a DGI officer, testimony by Congress, photographs where she is knowingly being, yeah, it's not like somebody surreptitiously, you know, secretly took photos of her, photographs that she posed for with known intelligence officers. And then most importantly for me at the end was I had access through a colleague to a debriefing, recent debriefing of a former DI officer who was worked in what is called M1, U.S. targets. But more specifically, he worked the academic section of U.S. targets. And in the first half of the 1990s, now this is the critical part because she says that her support of the regime ended back in the 80s. Her case officer recalled meeting with her in Ottawa, Canada in mid-1991, and she was still an active agent of Cuban intelligence. So no matter how she tries to spin it that this may have been an indiscretion of her youth, I've got the notes from her case officer who outed her. So
her
usefulness to the regime ended, you know, when that second officer stepped forward.
I want to just add real quick, both the Montes case and the Perez Estable case, I guess, beg the question. I mean, they'd have to be incredibly lucky to have, recruit someone at an early age, have that person blossom into the positions of influence that they ended up in. To me, it's more likely than rather than they were two for two in those two cases that there's literally hundreds of people that they've recruited that many of them never amounted to anything or never got anywhere, but they're only the tip of the iceberg. Perhaps there's people that attempted but never achieved anything, but certainly they're out there recruiting all the time.
Yeah, I was going to ask that earlier about sleeper agents and long term projects of the Cuban intelligence service.
I'd be happy. I will have to disagree with you because for all intelligence services, it comes down to resources, and so we need to set aside the idea that Cuba or any other services out there, with a lantern, so to speak, looking for someone who will be an agent. The approach they and others take is it's very businesslike in the terms of think for a second of what universities in the United States produce the most graduates that go on into State Department, the FBI, the CIA, and so forth. And so it's not a matter of you need to look at 3,000 different universities. What's become very clear to us from defectors, and Jose Cohen did a very nice piece on academic espionage several years ago, where there's actually, if you listen to the defectors and emigres, there are about 15 to 20 universities, and only 15 to 20 universities that Havana concentrates on. Places like UVA, MIT, Harvard, Johns Hopkins, Georgetown, and others, that they don't need to look at all the others. They've planted agents in these universities, And the agents look for the next generation of spies.
It's insidious, Chris.
So that when the State Department comes to the Ivy Leagues and the other schools to recruit America's best and brightest, they've already been paraded in front of Cuban intelligence.
Hmm.
And so, yeah, that's the approach they take of it's illogical to catch them once they're in. You go fish the pool that the Americans are going to go into, get your agents there, and let the Americans catch people who are already your asset.
You know,
and it's worked very well for them.
You know, the influence is so insidious that I hope this is a wake up call to people who don't take the influence of Cuba seriously in these matters. And it's been something that I've known about as long as I've been alive, just about. And it's a very serious threat to this country. I mean, we have various threats facing us now. You know, radical Islamists, the Chinese, but Cuba is right up there with the threats. With what
oh, exactly.
They can do.
Well, and you have to. I think we as a nation were taught a serious lesson by Havana regime and how comfortable they were in operating right in front of us with the Cuba Study Group when it was at Georgetown University, because you had Dr. Cole attending, Ana Montes attending, Gillian Gunn hosting, you had Cuban intelligence officers from the intersection attending. So out of a population of 20 to 30 academics and others that would be the core group of the Cuba Study Group, 10% were known Cuban agents. And so when you look at, you're exactly right, the ability of a small group of people to influence everything was just, it's mind-boggling, and they got away with it for years.
Is that Cuba Study Group isn't the same Cuba Study Group that's currently chaired by Carlos Saladrigas? I don't believe it is.
That study group migrated over to Trinity and was run by Dr. Gunn until she left academia recently. And I've got to talk to Trinity University to update their webpage, which still shows her as running their Cuba program.
Mm. Chris, we have one last call on the board that we have to take, and he's been extremely patient. Something that I don't possess a lot of patience. But 301 area code, you're on the air now.
Hello?
Yeah, 301 area code?
Yes, I'm 301 area code.
Hi.
Hello, yes, I've been here from the beginning because I grew up with Marifeli Perez Estable. And what's her status right now?
I believe she's still active at FIU as a professor, if I'm not mistaken.
But is she a spy? Has she been caught as a spy, or she hasn't? I mean, I have a group of friends that are very, very concerned and are listening in because we all grew up together. I mean, as normal children, not as any liberals or left-handed people.
Well,
I mean,
first,
liberals.
Let me address real quick, and then Colonel Simmons can address in terms of what her legal status is. As far as she's a citizen, she has been denounced by several people, including former members of the Cuban intelligence service. Marifeli's leanings or pro-Castro leanings are, at least in her past, because she has changed her outward stance in recent years. But her sympathies with the regime dating back to the 70s and 80s are no secret. So if you're just hearing about this for the first time, I'd be very, very surprised.
No, I knew about her leanings all along, but there's a big difference between having leftist leanings and being a spy.
Well, that's correct, and I think the distinction, as we've made earlier tonight, is that she's been accused by defectors of the regime of being in charge of programs and being an agent of influence for the regime. I'll let Colonel Simmons address.
Caller, thank you for calling. I'm going to put you on hold. Thank you very much for your call. Go ahead,
Bill. Excellent question. Again, I'm here as a private citizen tonight, so I cannot speak for the Justice Department as to what will happen to her in the future. I know right now, to the best of my knowledge, she still has ties with the Miami Herald, FIU, the Association for the Study of the Cuban Economy, to which she was recently elected as a board member. All of that is still in play. The Miami Herald is doing a story on her and the others I named, which may come out as early as tomorrow. I am told if not tomorrow, it'll come out sometime before the weekend or over the weekend. And that story will give them a chance to explain their side, in addition to my claims.
Yeah, I hate to interrupt us here, but Blog Talk Radio seems to have basically turned the lights off and closed the door. I don't know if we're even...
We're still recording. They turn off your control panel.
Okay,
but
the control panel is off. So it's basically you, me, and Lieutenant Colonel Simmons.
That's correct.
Left.
For the
rest of the
duration.
Podcast.
All right. Okay,
I'm sorry
for those that download it.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
It comes down to justice and FBI can arrest these agents should they so choose. And in a perfect world, they would do all four of them. But again, from a counterintelligence perspective, if you remember when we started talking, I said for people like me, our job is to identify, neutralize, or eliminate.
Yep.
And if serving people with a burn notice, so to speak, ends your value to the regime,
so be it.
There will be some injustice that will argue, why prosecute? Why spend hundreds of thousands of dollars prosecuting when she and the others have already been—they're neutralized.
Yeah, they're of no useful value to the regime.
Exactly. Take the resources and focus them on others that are still in play.
I think that's a great point, and that's obvious. I mean, to me, ever since you've been speaking to the media, it's been obvious that to me that there's certainly that element there in terms of neutralizing the capacity of these people to do future harm is important. And we also have to, I recently went to jury duty and I blogged about it and was reminded of what the standard of evidence is in a criminal proceeding, which is extremely high, as it should be in our form of government. What that means is, there's a lot of evidence, there's a preponderance of evidence, but there's not necessarily evidence that could be brought out in a court because it's sensitive in nature. You take it to a jury, you never know what could happen. But as you said, there's other ways to serve the purposes of our country, which is to make sure that these people don't do any more damage than they've already done. Obviously, a person like Marifeli doesn't rise to the level of someone like a Anibal M. Montes, where we already said, could have been responsible for the death of American servicemen, more than likely was responsible for the death of Allied servicemen, in my opinion, she's been discredited, and she's been for a long time, but it's now coming to light, and the Herald, will have to react to it, and I'm glad to see that.
I hope they do. I want to go ahead and close us off here. We're not even Henry. You and I are going to have to sing the Babaloo closing theme, which is going to be horrible.
Babaloo!
I mean, my goodness, we're gonna scare away our listeners with that. I want to thank you, Lieutenant Colonel Simmons, for appearing on our show. You've got an open invitation to call us whenever you want to appear. I would love to do another show with you talking about other issues as well, directly related to all of these topics. I, for the longest time, I found this to be a very fascinating field of independent study. So
we didn't even get a chance to talk about Alberto Cole,
and the others. And I'm, to a certain degree, I'm glad because we covered a lot of material that I think our English-speaking audience really, really needs to listen to, and I hope they'll download the podcast, which should be available probably in about half an hour, 40 minutes after we sign off. But I wanted to give you my sincere and heartfelt thanks for appearing on the show, and maybe we can definitely schedule something within the next month or so and have you back and talk about other issues as well, because this has been absolutely fascinating. We've been on the air almost 2 hours, and the 2 hours have flown by.
Thank you so much.
And that's the best compliment any host can give a guest. They've absolutely flown by. Thank you very much. Henry, do you want to go ahead and risk it?
No, I got it here. Hold on.
Oh, okay, beautiful. See, this is the beauty of the Internet. There you go. All right, thank you all for listening, and until next week, I don't know who we're going to have scheduled for next week, but hopefully they're going to have a hell of an act, a hard act to follow. Thank you all for listening, and good night.
Good night.
Good night, Lieutenant Colonel Simmons. Thank you.